Hi, before we begin, allow me to express gratitude and also pass some announcements. This goes to the returning listener. Thank you so much for being the heartbeat of this podcast. And if you're new here, be sure you hit the subscribe button wherever you're listening in so that you do not miss out on the future episodes. Subscription is free, but some listeners drop in some coins for support. And last week's podcast donation came from Esther. Thank you so much, Nyabo. If you would like to donate to the podcast just like Esther, you can make a deposit on +256 770 338 440. +256 770 338 440. The number is registered in the names of Nyabo Network. So thank you in advance. The other way that you can support the podcast and get something in return is by purchasing any of the Thrivis products. Thrivis is the first mental health product line with affordable products that you can use whenever you need something to lean on for emotional and mental support. Currently, we have coloring books of all ages and affirmation mugs. Check out Thrivis on Facebook and Instagram. Hello and welcome to the 140th episode of Hashtag with Nyabo Guzichwanke. This is the number one African millennial podcast that sits at the intersection of mental health, self-discovery, and personal growth. Today we are taking a dive into the powerful memoir Rough Silk, written by Deborah Aoko Tendo. Join me as I chat with Deborah herself about her remarkable story, exploring themes of family, identity, poverty, mental health, and resilience. We'll delve into the deeper meanings of some texts in the book and discover how Deborah's experiences have shaped her life and writing. This is more like a book review that will leave you inspired and reflective. Let's dive in.
Tendo, you are very, very welcome to Hashtag with Nyabo Guzichwanuka.
Thank you.
I'm truly honored. Like, we had the mini chat before the recording. I'm going to tell you what happened. So I got to see you, or I got to know about your existence through Rough Silk.
Yeah.
At that time, I had increased the number of Kenyans in my social media listing.
Okay.
And I started seeing them sharing profile pictures. They were actually changing their profile pictures to the image on Rough Silk.
Yes.
And it made me want to know what this was about. Because at every turn, there was like someone else. I was like, okay, what's going on? And then,
yeah,
finally, the information comes out.
Mm-hmm.
And I see your name.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, okay, what's going on? At that time, mm-hmm. I had already seen someone who is Kenyan, but had a name that seemed Ugandan.
Yeah.
I am seeing Tendo and I'm like, okay, who are these Ugandans in Kenya? Or who are these Kenyans that possibly have friends in Uganda? Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay, let me see what this person is about. So I think I followed you and got interested in the book, got it.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, the very first pages, I was annoyed. I was like, this chick just wrote a book to shame the father. I was angry with him. I was like, but why? Because I was like, how dare he? And then at the same time, like, why would she write this book?
Yeah, I know.
Until I went into it and I was like, oh my goodness.
Mm.
This is just a human being.
Mm.
Yeah. So let us get into the full breadth of this conversation.
Okay.
And for us to start, I feel like we're going to start from towards the end of the book.
Okay.
It's a question that I've always wanted to ask. Or something that I've always wanted to debunk. I don't know what you're going to say about it. But there is this idea that social media is not a real place.
Okay.
Where do you stand on that?
I don't believe that social media is not a real place, to be honest. By a good majority, the people posting are real. Mm-hmm. The people commenting are real people. you found me on social media. I found you on social media. And here we are having a conversation.
That's right.
I think the issue of social media not being a real place always comes from the notion that people are fake, mm-hmm. that people are only showcasing, you know, the positive side, the good things, you know, the good stuff. But I believe even in real life, nobody will meet you and tell you, hey, I'm a murderer, or hey, I'm a thief. Nobody writes on their CVs that they spend the whole day on the internet. You know, wherever we are as human, it's a human thing for people to showcase their good sides. And whether you're meeting them on social media or whether you're meeting them in real life, at the end of the day, people are always showing the good stuff. Nobody's always out here, you know, projecting the negative aspects of them. So I think for us, it's really up to us to use our intuition, to look at consistency, to sift out who is real, who is fake, what is real, what is fake. Because just as we have fake people on social media, we have fake people in real life, you
That's
know. Right. But at the end of the day, it's a real place. That is how you and I met, and that is how we're having a conversation here.
I like how you're insisting on that. It's making me like, oh my God. Do you guys know that I'm talking to Deborah?
I'm actually very excited to talk to you. I've watched your podcasts and I think you're really, 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 really amazing.
Thank you really so much. I'm truly, truly honored. Thank you
so
much.
Yeah. When you asked me, I didn't even hesitate. I was like, yeah, let's do it tonight.
I ran. Because how am I going from being starstruck to this person responding immediately? And with a yes, there are no doubts. And I think I've shared this with a couple of people that I invite on the podcast.
Yeah.
It kind of makes me, I don't know, I can't even describe the emotion behind it. But I feel like they're risk takers or something.
Yeah, it's all that. And then, I mean, it's a conversation. It's a conversation. And if you're out here, first of all, it depends on who's asking you, you know. I mean, I've been asked to attend some podcasts and interviews where I just say, just like I told you, an outright yes, I just say an outright no, you know. Mm-hmm. It depends also on your host, the person, what is the work they're doing, what do they lean on mostly, you know, what are their philosophies. Yeah. And as I've told you, I listened to your podcast and I liked it. And I said, yeah, absolutely. This is a space that I would like to be in. Absolutely. Oh yeah.
It's very affirming.
Thank you.
Now, just to give, I'm really blushing. Just to give a brief background.
Can we get on with this?
Oh my goodness. Just to give a brief background to someone who might not know who you are. Introduce yourself, and then we are going to fully, for those that do not have Rough Silk, I don't know if I should say I'm sorry for you, but at the end of the podcast, I'm sure you have figured out how to get a copy for yourself. So Deborah, let us get into an understanding of who you are. How do you feel about yourself? Who is Deborah Awuko?
Okay, so I'm Deborah Awuko. I adopted the name Tendo. Obviously, you have to read the book to understand where it comes from. Do you want to know about me? There's just so many facets of me. I don't know whether you want to know about me professionally or me as a person.
Both.
There's so many facets.
Both.
Is all of it?
Both. We're here for it.
Okay. So basically, I'm a trained lawyer, but I moved from the law profession into corporate law. Then I moved from corporate law to logistics. So professionally, what I do is logistics. I'm also a security consultant, both public and private. And I'm a dangerous goods specialist. I'm trained in that from the UK. And outside that, I consider myself a person who loves books. I'm a creative animal, which means I write a lot. I love paintings. When I can, I do paint. I love music. I love the creative process. I think I lean a lot towards creatives. Yeah, of course, I'm a mother of three kids, and I live in Kenya. So I'm half Kenyan, half Ugandan. I'm a citizen of East Africa. Generally, I'm an extrovert, very extroverted human being. And I don't need any, what's it called? I don't need any motivation I don't drink, but I best believe wherever I am, I'm probably the noisiest. I'm the most active. So I'm self-propelled, you know? Yeah. So basically that's just what to know about me. I'm very big on women issues. And actually that's why I'm here, my dear. If it was a dude, probably would have had to have more conversation. But I like women's spaces. I love women. I love women oriented situations, businesses, anything women, I'm in. Yeah. So in a nutshell, that's who I am.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for that. You've mentioned a couple of things that you did. And somewhere yes. you also mentioned that you were a lawyer and left.
Yes.
I don't know. Somehow I was like, I think it's also time for me to leave this lawyering thing.
Oh my God. You know what? I actually was, I don't know. You know the way we grow up and we live our parents' dreams?
Yeah.
So my dad was a lot around, you know, he was not like, he did get a degree, you know, and so he worked in the law circles a lot, mm-hmm. you know, he used to work for a lawyer and all that. So I think his dream was for his children to become, at least one of us, to become a lawyer, you know, mm-hmm. and so he kept on drumming it into my head as I was growing up and all that. And I mean, eventually it was the only thing that I could do because it's what I chose when I was leaving high school, going into university. And it's all he wanted. I really wanted just to make him happy until I graduated. And then after that, oh my God, I was bored to death. You know, I hated to yeah. stay in court. I hated the registry. I hated everything about it. And that is why I decided, no, let me go corporate and see maybe things are better that way, you know.
Right.
And so even as I got into the corporate law life, I left the legal department and went into operations and all that, where things are more interesting. So yeah, I don't think originally I was really meant to be a lawyer. Let me tell you, if it was up to me, my dear, mm-hmm. I would be probably a painter.
Wow.
Yes, I would probably be a painter. I would be in the creative life. Only that I think in Africa, you really have to work like 10 times harder for you to make a break, you know, as a creative, whether it's a painter or something like that. So ideally, if I was to be told what was I born to do that would make me really feel good about to lead a fulfilling life, like when I wake up in the morning, I look forward to doing whatever it is, it would probably be a painter. Yeah.
That's interesting. And now before I forget, I want to make a promise. I want to send yes. you, I have coloring books. I'm going to send okay. you a copy to Kenya.
Thank you. I will appreciate.
I'm going to send you a yeah. copy before I forget.
Uh-huh.
And now you mentioned...
I'll remind you.
You'll remind me. Oh my God.
I'll remind you.
Okay. Okay, that's very interesting. And now that we are talking about promises, the pages, actually page 78 of your book.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's where my tears started. Oh, Jesus. That moment, I forget the place where you went with your dad.
Mm-hmm.
And because he had promised to take you to mm-hmm. a place that even when he couldn't afford it,
yeah.
he took you there. He couldn't yeah. afford a meal for two.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm even shaking as I say it. He couldn't afford a meal for two.
Yeah.
But he made sure that he comes true to his... Oh, I'm teary again. Oh my God.
You're making me teary on this side too, you know? It was such a beautiful moment, and I don't think I appreciated it. In fact, let me tell you, I don't think I appreciated it. Then, as a child, you feel this is what you deserve. You get, you feel this is what you deserve. Of course, you're position one in school, and this guy has been promising you. I mean, as I've told you, we grew up poor. Franchises like so in Kenya we had the Wimpy. Wimpy was like a franchise. It was like the Nando's of right now. And whatnot, and it's only people who are like, you know, well to do that could actually afford it. Yeah. So anytime we passed by the CBD, that is the city center in Nairobi, I would look at Wimpy and, you know, I would wonder what sort of food is being, you know, is being cooked here, what sort of people, you know, and you can see, of course, the people who are eating there, you know, very established families, the children looked, they look spoiled, the cars that are parked outside there, you know. So while us, we would be going to eat like fries from like the downtown where it's so cheap and there's just a lot of, you know, rotten potatoes in there. You really, you have to vet the potatoes. By the time you're done vetting the potatoes, you're left with like half the pack, you know. Yeah. So I really longed to eat there, and I always used to tell Dad when he asked me, so if no, when he used to tell me, so you're gonna be number one this time, I'm like, yeah, but if I'm number one, what are you going to do? What are you going to do to me? Then he would ask me, okay, so what would you like for me to do to you? And then I would be like, I would like you to take me to Wimpy. I would like to eat at Wimpy. And so this promise went on for so many years, you know, until one time now I just reminded him out of nowhere, I've become number one yet again, and you know, I need to go to Wimpy. And you know, I didn't know that he was taking me there. So this particular scene, when now we are at Wimpy, at that point, I feel like I deserve it. I feel like it's my right. I've been number one, you know. Mm. And then we go. You know, as a child, it doesn't occur to you that this guy can't afford
it's your parents, second pack.
It doesn't occur to you. You know, you guys are so used to luck, you yeah. know. And then we go back home. But now as you grow up, you know, you look back and you're like, wow, this guy could not actually afford for two. So he bought for one. But I'll tell you something for sure, my dear, is that when I was writing this book, that there's a reason why probably you felt it on that page 78 is when I was writing this book is when I sat back and actually reflected on that moment.
It was and when you were writing the book, that's when you got to reflect.
When I actually, yeah, it's when I actually, you know, it dawned on me because now I'm a parent, I have a children,
yeah,
you know, I have children. We walk in and out of Nando's, we walk in and out of any franchise we want, you know, without even thinking about it twice. So I got to sit down with myself and look back at that moment. Him being the adult, now putting myself as the adult, I've gone into like a franchise with my son, Romeo or Zola or whoever, you know? And I'm at that moment where I'm buying him, yeah, the kind of sacrifice it would require from me to buy him one meal and to sit watching him eat because I had made a promise to him, number one, and because this is important to this child, you know?
Yeah.
And to go through that internal shame of, I cannot afford for two, I can only afford for one.
Right.
I'm telling you, there's no point that, there's so many points that I've loved my dad, and that was really, really one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It must have been at that, I don't know when exactly, but it could be at that moment when I probably stopped getting angry with him. But then by the time I get to 78, I must have already started loving him. 78 are so many pages.
Yeah.
And the reason why we are truly, truly having this conversation, parts of Rough Silk resonated with me.
Wow.
And I tend. You were supposed to send us wipes. You were with the book.
I'm so sorry.
We needed to have tissue coming along with the books, just in case.
Oh.
It should have been a package of just in case, because this moment, and I think that why it still makes me teary, is because I've also grown in luck.
Okay.
And there's a time, I think, when my mom bought me a pair of shoes. I must have been at the university.
Okay.
And my first instinct was, the moment I saw the shoes, I was like, and these shoes expensive. Like, I wanted to tell her, you don't have to. I'm okay. You don't have to prove to me anything. And I think my response was, but you're also expensive.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
So you see all these things, you're used to just the minimum. And I was like, oh my God, these people do just so much that we might not see.
Yeah.
Or even appreciate as children.
Yeah. Yeah.
What did that do for you on fulfilling promises?
Okay. It's something that obviously my dad taught me that at the end of the day, when you make a promise, you really have to keep it. I really struggled with people who don't keep their promises because I take people's words very seriously. If we sit down and we decide that we're going to do something or you're going to do something and you say you're going to do it, I will absolutely get it off my list. Like for me, I take people's words very seriously that I actually take it off my list and I move on to something else.
Right.
So it's always a bummer when now we have to come back and revisit something that I'd already put at the back of my, you know, at the back of my list. So obviously things happen and things can change and, you know, people can break promises for one or two reasons that are actually, you know, are actually relevant or was important, you know, but it's always good to tell somebody in advance, I'm not going to be able to do this thing. I really love it when people are very forthright with me on what they can do and what they cannot do. Mm. And you realize that even later on, my dear, as I grow up with my dad and actually, I don't want to jump the gun. I think let's go slowly with this. So when it comes to promises, I take promises seriously. And I also, when I promise, and especially children, when I promise a child something, I always ensure that I know it is something that I'm able to do. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So for those that may not have a clear understanding of what rough silk is, the summary of it is that it's about the relationship of our guest right now and her dad. And Deborah, there is somewhere in the book where you're like, the present parent is more important, no matter how bad the situation is. And we see you in the book being trouble, let's say in school, and and calling out anyone who has done something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But then in your story, there is no moment I may have seen you giving your father trouble. Even
okay.
when, like I said in the beginning, I was like, what the heck? Why did this chick write about this? Or what was this man thinking? I didn't see anywhere where you were calling him out or giving him headache. Is there something that you could have, what was going on? What could have been going on in your head?
Okay, first of all, my dear, you have to understand the psychology of abandonment when you have been rejected by a primary caregiver, like a mother.
Mm.
It is so specific and it is so, so profound that whoever picks you become almost, and they become almost like a god to you. They're beyond reproach. So, and especially if it happens in childhood, you know, we are modeled in our psychology is modeled while we are children.
Yeah.
You know, and so if that is affected, when you are rejected at your formative stages as a child, the person who picks you or the person who shows you love becomes almost like a god. And the one thing is about my dad is he was consistent about it. From the word go. So it didn't matter what was going on. He kept on picking me. He kept on choosing me.
Mm.
You get? So what does this do to me? It makes me basically accept him.
Yeah.
Accept the package. You get what I mean? Accept the package for its ills and for its good. Like, I cannot even separate. It's to the point of, it's the sort of conditioning that comes with, you can't even separate what is wrong and what is right. For as long as this guy is on your on your right side and you're on their right side, you're good. So it also had a lot to do with accepting that he was human and that he did one thing right, which was to accept me, to affirm me and to understand me. So I know that there were far more people that seemed more perfect than him, but who did not see me. So in their perfection, they did not exist to me. Mm. The person who existed to me was him. He was present throughout. Mm. So you have to understand this from the point of the rejection by a primary giver and the person who actually chooses you and picks you. So it's a very problematic aspect, but it is how trauma works, you get.
Mm.
So, but if you read the book up to towards the end, you realize in India when we were just the two of us.
Yeah.
I actually confronted him about my mother, and I confronted him about all the women that he had in his life and how he messed up their lives. And I remember it was that moment, it was one of those moments in the book when he tells me he's sorry. And his sorry was so heavy and probably I needed that sorry so many years back, you know? Probably I needed that sorry so many years back that when it eventually came, I ended up crying in that mattress down on the floor in India, if you remember.
Wait,
so I think that was one of those moments when I was able to like confront him, yeah.
It's like I don't have a recollection of that.
It's in India. Yeah.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
There was so much tension about him being okay.
I probably understand you. By the time people reach, in this book, by the time you reach in India, you really want to just move on to the next, to find out how this story ends.
No, I was, no, so that moment in India, I was also looking forward to the moment where you mentioned Minge. Because now when you mention that, I do remember, I think, when you're having conversation in the dark.
Yeah.
But then I don't have a recall. I don't know. I don't really have a
recollection. So there's this time when he starts talking to me about my mom, like he keeps on trying to make me understand my mom. Mm-hmm. You know, we have that moment when he tells me about my mom, how he met my mom, how beautiful my mom was and all that. And he keeps on trying to tell me to forgive my mom. My mom was not. Yes, but my mom was not perfect. But, you know, and at that point, I tell him, please, let's talk about you. Let's not even talk about mom. Let's talk about you and what you did, why she ended up the way she did. Yeah, so it's one of those rare moments in the book when I actually take my mom's side and I speak on her behalf.
Oh, my God. Where was I? If it was a movie, I would be like, I was distracted. I missed something. What happened? I need to go back to the book.
Yeah, but by and large in the book, I let him get away with a lot. You're right with that aspect, actually. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. As a woman, as a mother, as a wife, I let him get away with a lot in the book.
Yeah.
But that's the psychology of the trauma that I grew up with. Yeah.
And for that, where you treasure him so much, what was the worst that you imagined when you were looking for the Alex Minge family?
Okay, so the thing about that, the thing is, my dear, just as I told you, I don't like letting people down, you know, and what my dad did to me was so profound to me, and it meant so much to me that I felt that looking for my roots, my real roots, was betraying him.
Right.
It was letting him down. It was me being ungrateful for all that he did to me. It was me being not seeing that he picked me even when the people who were actually related to me did not pick me, you know. So I just that was the weight that I was carrying, that the fact that I wondered how he would feel. I was being empathetic to his feeling after struggling with me for this long, and that now I have made it, I'm a big girl, I have my whole career, now I'm looking for, you know, my people. I just felt that it would be betrayal and it would hurt him, and that was the last thing that I would have wanted to happen to him, yeah.
Because I waited till the end of the book. I was like, oh my God, how is this man going to take this news? Oh my goodness. You really left a couple, I'm sure you left a couple of us on the edge, like, oh my God, she better not.
I know.
Oh my God. Because that moment when it was just the two of you in India, it's like, oh my goodness.
It's going to happen. Yeah, everybody thinks it's at that point that I'll tell him. And let me tell you, I actually had the mind to tell him or to ask him.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had the mind to ask him and to tell him. Now, why would you think that this information would change who I am, how I feel about you, and all that? Why would this information change me? Why would you hide it from me this long when it's so obvious, you know? And then I felt sorry for him. He was unwell. I never got a good time for us to discuss it, really.
Yeah. And then, you know, when this question came, when I was trying to get this conversation piece together, it reminded me that the scene about the birth certificate.
Yeah.
Because I was like, wait, I feel like that's a time where she should have not.
So you see, it was one of those very, very awkward moments that the two of us had. And as a daughter, I was now 18, you know, I expected him to take the lead. You know, I expected him to take the lead and say, okay, so this is what's up. Because mom had already died.
Yeah.
You know. So I expected him to take the lead. That's why when he took me off the cells, the prison cells, when we got outside, I write in the book that we had this awkward moment or an unspoken conversation that is quiet. You know the way you can have a conversation with somebody and it's quiet, like your eyes, like you tell this guy with your eyes, hi, you want to tell me, like, I'm not your, what is this all about? You want to tell me I'm not your child?
Yeah.
And his eyes tell you, let's not go there. It's okay, let's not go there. You know, that's what we had. And I just kept quiet. I moved on.
Right.
Yeah.
And when we are looking at your relationship, this is like an oath of through thick and thin.
Mm-hmm.
There is luck for the most part. The biggest story is luck. And seeing the Tendo of today, woman. One of the reasons why I was like, no, I don't think she's the one who is responding. The number of countries, I don't know how many times you travel, right?
I travel a lot for work. Yeah.
This is a different Tendo from the, I think you guys call them shags. Now, if we're looking at a Tendo growing up in luck, how did you come to reconcile your relationship with money? And I'm asking this question because I am just learning how to get out of this sphere of luck. I find myself, and this is work I've just started doing last year. I had to go back in the day to understand what is this? That I have with money. Why is it that I don't have money all the time? And I noticed that when I have money, if money lands in my hands, I make sure it gets done real quick so that I go back to default settings.
So now
the question that is coming to your way right now, how has your money perception changed over the years? Like, what kind of work, is there any kind of work that you had to do with yourself?
I've had a lot. Number one, one also of the reasons why I left the law profession is it wasn't paying as much in Kenya when I started practicing, right? And so I had to go to corporate because they were paying more. So that was first of all the first decision that I made that had to do with the fact that I am very focused on making money.
Yeah.
And then thereafter, my dear, I work like a horse. It doesn't even matter how much money I get. I just want to ensure that, and especially my greatest fear is my children. Now, after having children, I remember when I gave birth to my son, Zola, my kid, yeah? Mm-hmm. When I looked at this child, I felt a sense of responsibility. And I felt a sense of fear. What if this child goes through what my brother Philip and I went? You know, where you have to go to neighbors, you know, you have to babysit. You have to babysit to even get a meal.
Yeah.
And I just said, what can never happen is that sort of luck for my children. I'm going to go out here and I'm going to work so damn hard.
Yeah.
I'm going to work so damn hard. So number one, I'm a workaholic in a certain aspect in terms of I handle, as you can see, I'm trained in so many things. So I handle so many jobs at the same time. It reached a point when I actually resigned from work and I requested that I do not want to be a permanent employee. I want to be on contract. Yeah. Because being a permanent employee means going to work at 8 and leaving at 5. I don't have that time to sit in anybody's office, you know, for pay at the end of the month. So I told them I will be working on commission. I will go out here and get the business that I need to get. You pay me on commission. But at the same time, I'll still do my dangerous goods specialist consultations. I'll still do my whatever, what are they called? The security consultancy. So I have like about three jobs all running at the same time. And even if you have watched how I've moved with Rough Silk, it will tell you the kind of commitment I put in when I have to work. You know, yeah. I go in there and I go in there deep and I get the money. Mm-hmm. That's the good part about it. The sad part about it, just like you, it will get, the money will get itself out of my hands so fast. So the first thing is I realized that anyone who asks me for money, I'm going to give them. It's so difficult for me. It was so difficult for me to say no. You know, any problem that is there, I'll try to resolve it. I'll try to sort it out. Partly because I have the money, but secondly is, I think I grew up because of that issue of not being loved by a primary caregiver. I ended up almost at the border of people pleasing. I felt like if I give people whatever it is that they need from me, then I'm on their good side. You get? So, and most of the time, what people need from us is money. So I ended up, it's always, I'm giving money here, I'm giving their money there. There's a crisis here, you find me contributing the most, you find me doing this, you find me doing the most when it comes to money. Yeah. So yes, I'll get the money, but at the same, it will go away at the same rate. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's number two. Then number three, I am a person who understands that I have to enjoy my life. Yeah, this has obviously come from also my background of that suffering.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw that, and people die, people do all sorts of things, people leave their property, people leave. So one of the things that I even told my spouse when I met, I told you, one thing please expect about me, I'm about the life. I want to enjoy my life. Mm. I suffered so much when I was so young that now that I can afford it, I want, as far as my money can afford, I want to go to the good places. I want to eat good food. I want to live my life I want to compensate for what I lacked. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I would say that is who I am when it comes to money. I work hard to get money. I'm really afraid of not having money. I'm really afraid of not having money. That is why I do as much as I do. And then secondly, and this is something I've healed from, and I've been called out quite a bit by close friends, the issue of just giving people money, you know. Mm. Anyone comes up with anything, I've given them money. There's money needed somewhere, I'm giving money. So somebody told me that this is an aspect of, you know, people pleasing, and you probably need to look why you are like that. Like, you can't save the world. You know, what are you trying to prove, you know? And so I have probably healed from that. I no longer feel obligated. It's easy for me to tell someone no nowadays. Yeah, even if I have the money in the bank and you come to me, I can just tell you no, I don't have that money right now, or it's not a priority for me right now. It's something I've grown to be able to do. But on the luxury life part, my dear, I'm not promising anything. That is me compensating. that's basically me and my money.
I found it to be an important question to ask, because I think for someone that grows in luck, there is a way how you, like I mentioned on my part, I feel like I get anxious, like, what? I have this. Oh my God. So what can we get? And then before I know it, I'm back to default settings and I'm just comfortable with it. I'm like, yeah, this is where I'm known. Until I started doing the work and started keeping money with myself. Now I started having this conflict of, wait a minute. Mm. So who are you if you're not in luck?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that side of me, I could not really comprehend. I felt like I was being an imposter, first of all, because who are you to sit down and say that you have money? and I had to talk to myself a lot. I was like, calm down. It is okay. And it is something I'm still working through.
Yeah. But the money says a lot about our growing up. You'll find there are people who just give out the money, or there are the people who grew up in lack and they keep the money. Like, they're extremely, extremely, extremely. They would never give anybody their money. What gives them fulfillment in life is to see just how fat their bank accounts are. So it's both extremes. There are people who keep the money and then there are people who get the money going.
But we're happy to see the flourishing Deborah. Hey,
I go overboard sometimes. I'm so sorry.
And especially for the time when you were traveling, I was like, but then how is she going to have my time? Who am I? Who am I
There's
to think that I can fit in a program? Like, there was a lot going on as well on my end.
And now
let us visit the emotional spectrum. We're still going. Mm-hmm. This is like a throwback.
Yeah.
Episode. If we have to draw back on the emotional spectrum, which were your easiest emotions to express when you were a child?
So I think the easiest emotions for me to express as a child was happiness.
Mm-hmm.
Because I did a lot of numbing whatever I was going through. When you go through a lot of the comments when it comes to people who spent their childhood with me, whether it's in primary school or whether it's in high school, they'll tell you that no, Tendo was one of the happiest people.
Is it?
Like this is not the same. You can't tell me this is a book written by Tendo. You get what I mean?
Yeah.
A lot of them read this book and they say, no, I can't relate to the person that I remember. So the easiest emotion for me was happiness. And because when trauma is happening to children, they tend to numb whatever it is that is going on. And then they create a fantasy life. You know, they create a fantasy life where everything is okay, everything is fine, everybody's happy, you know, and that is who I was. I was very happy. It was a very easy emotion for me when I was younger, and I was hilarious. Of course, there's also a lot of hiding behind humor, you know, right, where you make yourself laugh and you make people laugh.
Mm.
So a lot of people remember me. When you ask me what were the easiest emotions for me to, you know, to project, it really has a lot to do with the people who are seeing me then. What do they say about me? What were they seeing about me? And all of them will always say, I was always a happy child and I was always a hilarious person. Until I now get to high school. And now I'm now evolving into a teenager. I'm starting to question a lot of things. The things that I'm trying to number, I'm getting into this conflict stage of my life, and then now pain comes in.
Yeah.
And I'll say from the age of 16 going all the way to 19.
Mm-hmm.
Was it 19? Probably 18. 15 to 18, because my mother takes me to school and when I'm 15, and I was really angry.
Yeah.
From 15 to 18, I remember I was very angry. That was the easiest emotion for me. Anything small would set me off. I was a rebel. I was an activist. I was operating in my own world, in an institution. It was crazy. So I've definitely moved. It was me being a happy child who was not happy, going all the way into being a very hilarious and humorous person, and then getting into now my teenagehood where I'm very angry, and the easiest emotion for me to express is anger. And then, of course, I get my assault at the age of 18. And now, again, I go back into numbing whatever is going on with me with alcohol. You get?
Yeah.
So it has been coming of age, if we can say so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And when Mr. Brett, this is your teacher.
Yes, yes.
He got to a point when he asked you why you're angry.
Yeah.
Could you really find an answer to that question when he asked you? Because I think we never got into the details. But I think when he asked you that question, I paused as like, whoa. What has hit her?
Yeah. So that explains to you that, like, at that point, at that time in my life, what I was projecting what people could see, the anger, you know. And yeah, when he asked me that question, why are you so angry? He had seen it. He had seen it. Of course, I wasn't able to respond immediately. And so he really realized that I'm not the kind of person, or I was going through a lot. And so he decided to take some moments with me during prep. I think it was every Wednesday evening. I would have a session of 2 hours with him. Wow. We used to have our preps from 7 to 9 every evening, Monday to Saturday, except only Sunday. So he dedicated himself every Sunday. He was like a shrink every Sunday. No, not every Sunday, every Wednesday. He would just call me off class and I would go to his office and we would sit down and we would talk. You know, he started at the beginning. He was such an amazing guy. Tell me about your childhood. Tell me about your mother. The moment you ask me, tell me about your mother, the story will come. Tell me about your dad. Tell me about your mom. Tell me about, you know, and, you know, the moment you ask these things, the story will come. So, I spent a lot of time with him and we really spoke a lot about my life here.
And I found that moment. I found this moment.
Like, you found moments. You found the book a moment.
It was a whole moment. In there were very moments in one moment.
Yeah.
And now I saw for that part as, oh my goodness, the teachers do not realize the different kids they have in school. Some teachers, that is. Because you find that some schools are just going to expel a kid.
Yeah.
Punish the kid for all the time.
Yeah.
Without knowing what exactly it is, the emotional wars they're struggling with or maybe trying to shut.
And now, yeah, that's true.
And now in Rough Silk, there comes a Mr. Brett and I was like, what kind of book is this? This book has history of Kenya. It has... There's just,
thank you.
There's so many themes in there to a point that you cannot just tie it to one thing. There's so much to learn. And if we have to look at Mr. Brett, is he alive?
Yes, he's alive. He has the book. Oh. He read the book. He cried his head off. I'll be meeting him probably in May or June. Oh. We'll be going back to school together.
To school?
Yeah, we'll be going back to my school, my girls' high school, Eldoret.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll be going back to school. The kids have read the book and they're demanding, they need to see me, they need to talk to me. So I'll be going back to school to just have a moment with the children. And of course, Mr. Bett is going to be a part of it.
It's powerful because he told you that you have a story to tell.
Imagine that's what he told me when I was leaving school.
Yeah.
You know what? By the time Mr. Bett was asking me actually why I was angry, you have to know I was on my third year of school and I had already faced, I think, about 4 suspensions from school.
Ooh.
Yeah. So the only thing that was keeping me in school is I was delivering the A's. And, you know, Kenyan schools are commercial to that aspect. Everybody wants to show that the school is performing well. So you really cannot. If I was probably an average performer, I would have been expelled from school.
So they
kept sending me away. I come back. They send me away. I come back. Until he said, no, it can't be that this kid doesn't. It reaches a point like I don't. It's like I'm even asking for trouble myself. You know, I know this is going to land me in trouble, but I'll still do it, you know. And that's why he said, no, something is wrong with this child beyond just what we talk about in discipline. There's more to this child than what we're talking about. Yeah.
And do you feel like he may have contributed to your emotional well-being? Is there a change that you may have experienced?
Oh, my God. What do you mean? Absolutely. Absolutely. Mr. Bett is a star. And the wife, Mrs. Bett, they're absolute stars. Like, I've always said they should be given an award for Teacher of the Year or something. Those people were amazing. He was an absolute star. You know, kids spend a lot of time with teachers.
Exactly.
Kids probably spend more time with teachers than they spend even with their parents.
Yep.
I have emphasized in my book their role in broken families. Teachers see kids beyond their shame, beyond their brokenness. You know, teachers, all teachers see is potential. And that is what Mr. Bett saw in me. He saw beyond what I was struggling with to say, no, there's something more to this child. And that is what teachers see. When children go to school, teachers don't see who is rich, who's poor, who is what. They're looking at the ability to grasp things, to learn. You know, all these things, all the potential. This one is a good singer. This one will be a good actor. This one is a good writer. That's what teachers see. While the rest of the world sees us for maybe class and all that, teachers see different. And that is why I've always said teaching is a calling. Teachers who settle well in their jobs, it's a calling. If you find a teacher who is not settling well, it's not a calling. Because that is what teachers are supposed to be. So, yeah, in that aspect, Mr. Bett is a star. Mr. Bett helped me. I think when he started talking to me, the third year, I wasn't suspended. And on my last year, I think I was suspended only once. So that was a record.
It's funny how you said only once. Oh, my goodness. I'm supposed to be applauding him, but then when you're only once, like, oh, how many...
This one was unavoidable, so I had to go.
A big shout out, a big, big, big shout out to Mr. Bett. He definitely did a great job with his wife. You have talked about the moment when Mr. Bett had to ask you all these questions, and you're like, it's easier to tell the story when someone asks you about your mother.
Yeah.
And then we are looking at you in the book.
Yeah.
Battling tears when your mother passed on.
Yeah.
Was it loss or anger that she still had the audacity to leave before she mended your relationship with her?
So there's so many facets to it. The first one is, I think it doesn't matter what a mother does to you. Your mother is your first love, you know, that's where you came from. That is the person you are attached to, your umbilical cord. The love will always be there. Yeah. You know, the love will always be there. I've always told people that even on that day that my mother was passing on, I think I can even tell the hour because of how I felt as a person. You know, there you can just feel a sudden emptiness and you don't even know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So that when the news came, I knew, this is why I was feeling this way on this particular day,
yeah.
You know. So there's that aspect of your mother is your mother. There's nothing much you can do about it. You are born out. You've grown up in their womb. You'll always love them. That's number one. So there was that aspect of obviously loss. Number two, I really felt that when I started reaching out to her towards the end, we were going to build something.
Yeah.
It was not as toxic as it was at first when she was taking me to high school, you know. By the time I was reaching now my third year, I was already resigned to the fact that this is your mother. She may have done you bad, but, you know, you can still mend. I was in the mending phase with her.
Yeah.
That's why I kept writing to her letters. I kept sending my report form. I kept on trying. I mean, that is still trying to tell her that I'm still worthy. When I send you my report form, telling you, I topped in this. Oh, my essay was the top in the district or in the province. You know, I'm still trying to get to the good side of you, you know. So that was the other aspect. I still loved her. You know, and that was the number one. Number two, I was trying to mend and I was now being denied this opportunity. The third thing is my brother Philip loved our mother so bad. And I felt it was really unfair for him because at least me, I grew up to a certain point, up to 9 years when she came to school and I last saw her. And then again, I saw her in high school, when I was going to high school. My brother just never saw her. And he was young and he still believed in, you know, having a mother, you know, my mother loves me and all that. So he was going to miss all that for life, you know. I felt sorry for him. Part of why I struggled is I felt sorry for him. And then there's also the aspect of how she died, you know. Death goes just beyond the fact that a person has died. You know, this is why people say, you know, to console themselves, because at the end of the day, death is death. But you'll see people, things like she died peacefully. It was quick. She died in her sleep. You know, that is just basically to deal with how we feel about the last moments of this person, you know. Mm-hmm. And for her, it was not something you'll say she died peacefully or it was quick. It's not something you can say about her. She suffered, you know, she suffered for a long time. She suffered HIV and she suffered the stigma and the shame associated with the disease in the 90s. I can imagine living her life then, and it was really tough. I felt sorry for her. After all that struggle, at the end of the day, she died. I still love that woman, and I definitely I struggled with my emotions because of those three aspects.
Yeah. On page 27,
mm-hmm.
Was it 27? I hope I'm not mixing them up.
Mm-hmm.
By that time, mm-hmm. when you left school,
yeah,
and you just went on to look for her.
Yeah. That's evidence again, evidenced in the fact that I was still seeking her, you know? Mm. Yeah.
And that moment where she introduced you as her niece crushed me.
Yeah.
Because I don't have a relationship. I did not have any relationship with my dad. He died before I was born.
Okay.
And the only person I have in my life is my mother.
Okay.
So if I'm a child and is there a moment in your life where you felt like, I think I'm truly loved by my mother?
No.
Hmm.
Yeah, no, there's none.
Because now you had become my friend, even when I didn't know you, you had become my friend through the book. And then when it got to the, like, I'm advocating for Deb full time.
Yeah.
And then when it got to the point where she was like, how come you've never asked me about your father? I wanted to punch her. Like, stop that. When do you rest?
Yeah.
Like, that moment, I was like, is she kidding?
You don't think that it was a good thing, at least she did one thing right by ensuring that, okay, there are two ways to look at it. There are people who say she spoiled it for my dad, mm-hmm. who had been there for me throughout.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people who feel that she did one thing right by at least sending me back to my roots and giving me the choice to find my roots and if it will do anything for me as a person.
How she did it, probably I put a different tonation. And that's the thing with reading text. For me, I read it in this thing of, why are you still here? By the way, how come you've never asked me about it? Like, what the heck? Like, for me, it was like, this is what it communicated, that page or that sentence or question, what it communicated for me was that, how many times does she have to break her child?
Mm.
That's what came. I was like, no way. What?
It's one of those very interesting chapters. It's a chapter that when people reach there, they just put the book down because, come on, we've been on a very nice journey here as a family and whatnot.
Exactly.
How is this again, you know?
I'm sure I screamed, this woman. I'm very sure I did that. And in your introduction, you talked about yourself as a mother of three.
Yeah.
Given your history and introduction to motherhood, the relationship that you had with your mother.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you had a template to being a good mother? Is this something you even looked up to?
Okay. One thing about my book, my dear, is you realize that I had about five stepmothers. So some were crazy.
Man, like,
some were amazing. And some were really role models to me on what it means to be a mother. And one of them was Nyasamia.
Mm.
Actually, she is the one. And probably the Mikai, the first wife. The two of them, how they handled motherhood was something that having raised me for the few weeks, months, or a year or two that they did, it was something that was worth emulating, obviously, especially from Nyasamia. So it was not something that I thought that I could not do as a as a person, and I really looked forward to having my own children. But of course, if you have not been mothered, now when it comes to the practical sense of being a mother, it's very different, actually. So motherhood with mother wounds is it can be confusing. So first of all, you have fear because you don't want to fail, you know, at being a mother. You don't want any kids writing rough silk about you in the future, you know.
Right.
And there's also looking forward to being a mother. So you do the things that you are not done for. To be honest, I know sometimes I live my life precariously. I live through my children. Some of the things that satisfy me the most is seeing my children do the things that I wasn't able to do, or me do to them or for them things that nobody ever did for me. These are some of the times when I actually sleep very well at night, you know. But the dangerous thing about it is that it becomes difficult for you to be a natural mother sometimes, because sometimes you overcompensate. You're afraid of punishing your kids. You find it hard telling them no. Like if a kid needs something, you really cannot say no, you know. So you end up spoiling them and it's not good for them. And you must keep reminding yourself that it's your trauma mothering them, you know. So in that aspect, I'm very lucky to have, you know, like, you know, my husband who can basically just sit through me and tell me, no, 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 you don't have to do that. That's you now projecting your trauma on the children, you know. So mothering can be confusing, to be honest, but it's something definitely I look forward to.
I think that's something, because I was like, oh my goodness, so how did she come out of this? In the beginning, I had this imagination, could she have gone for therapy or something like that?
Yeah, I've gone for a lot of therapy, to be honest. I've gone through a lot of therapy, my dear. A lot. A lot, yeah. A lot. Even when it comes to parenting, taking care of my children and all that.
And when we get to unpack the emotions behind the bottle, because I think there's a time when your dad sat you down.
Yeah.
Do you have a memory of what it was exactly you were trying to numb?
Okay, so if you look at, if you read the book, you find that how I ran away from home is in this time when I'm assaulted by this Somali guy. And it's also the first time that I actually test alcohol, because when I scream, the ladies of the night who are living in the same guest house with us, they burst into the room and, you know, they pull this guy off me. And one of them runs back to her room and comes back with vodka, you know, and she puts the vodka in my mouth and, you know, I drink it. And it's at that point, it numbs what had just happened to me. It numbs everything and it gives me courage. You know, I'm the kind of person, when you look at this book, you realize I'm not the kind of person who could tell my dad, who could, just as you said, as we were beginning this podcast, I'm not the kind of person who could bring trouble for my dad, you know.
Right.
But it's at this point that I get the courage to even walk away from him. Yeah, so, and consequently in my life, I started using alcohol as a way of dealing with myself, you know, dealing with what I had been through, the various effects, the various traumas, everything that was going on with me. I found a way of dealing with them in alcohol. Alcohol made me so happy. I used to be so deliriously happy. You can't even believe it. And you know, I'm an extrovert, so you can imagine now I'm high.
I don't think I can
like
handle
a hurricane.
That. Yeah.
Yeah, so I drank to the point, I know my dad was my friend, so we used to go out together, you know, and he could see how I could drink, like I could do, and you know, like I could down a whole, you know, 1 liter of whiskey by myself.
Sure.
You know, yeah, and still function, still drive, tomorrow I'm working and all that. And of course he told me that you know that conversation, he told me he's worried about me and all that. And basically, my dear, I was just numbing everything that had happened to me. Everything from the rejection, the violence, the assault, the lack, abandonment, feelings of not being good enough, being unwanted. And I always felt very courageous with the world when I was high, until eventually I had to now face myself.
How did that go for you when you started facing yourself?
Yeah, it had to do with now when my dad was diagnosed with cancer. And I knew that if I drink, it was a moment that I needed to be sober, because I knew the gravity of what I was going to face, number one. And then number two, I needed to be mentally in a very, very sober space to deal with it. Mm. Because there are two things that would have happened to me. The sort of grief that I went through after my dad, and I went through it sober. If I would have gone through it drinking, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Right.
Yeah, we wouldn't be having this conversation, my dear. I went through hell, but I went through hell like a junkie who has stopped. Like, I had those moments when I thought, I think I could do with that drink, and I said, no. You have to go through this pain once and for all. And when my dad died, I went through the whole grief. I went through grieving for my mom, who I never grieved for. I went through grieving for him. I went through all the trauma that I had gone through. It all came rushing in.
Yeah.
And I went through it sober. You know, I said, I'm not drinking. Let me go through this pain once and for all. Yeah.
You know, that's a hard decision to make.
Yeah, it was really difficult. In fact, when I first said it, all my friends were laughing, knowing me, you know. Mm-hmm. They're saying, okay, see you next weekend, you know. And you remember, even when we were traveling, if you remember my journey with dad to India on the plane, he kept on calling the flight attendants,
yes,
telling them, get
that.
Her a whiskey.
I remember
get
that.
Her a whiskey.
I remember that.
And then I kept telling dad, I'm serious. I'm not drinking anymore. We have this
that.
Cancer thing to deal with, you know.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah.
How has self-care changed for you as the years go by?
Okay. So, wow, it's been many layers. It's been very many layers. When I speak to you, you see them, first of all, me being a child who is running away from what's happening to me and being the happy kid, the hilarious kid. Then I move from that to being the angry teenager.
Mm-hmm.
I move from being the angry teenager to being the girl in her early 20s, and the whole, I think all of my 20s, I spent them drinking. You now see me numbing my pain by drinking for like a whole decade. And then now as I get into my 30s, I become now sober because I have to deal with a certain trauma, which is now my dad passing. That is late 20s now. My dad passes, and then I have to deal with that. And then I now have to seek therapy. You know, I have to seek therapy. I have to seek all that. Now, the first one had to be forgiveness.
Yeah.
The first one had to be forgiveness. I had to forgive my mother. I know that I still shed tears because of unrequited love. You know, when you love somebody, it's like having love and giving it to a wall. It's not reciprocated. Mm. And so it stays with you.
Mm.
Yeah, so when I speak about my mom, I still shed tears because of unrequited love and unresolved issues. But I did forgive her. And I write it in the book that being a woman, being a mother right now, I can understand why she made the decisions she made, how old she was. She was what, 18, 19? At 18, 19, what was I doing?
Yeah.
You know, what she went through, that sort of cheating, what she saw with her own eyes, that trauma. It is, what decision would I have made if I was at her age? This marriage itself started on a lie. The guy lied, he was not married. Kumbe back at home, he has, I don't know how many wives. You get? It was too much for her to take. And people react in different ways, and that was her way of reacting.
Yeah.
You know, and I had to be a mother, and I had to be grown up to understand the decision she made. Obviously, there's the issue of why does she keep on rejecting me again and again? And this can be explained in the fact that she was a teen mom. She was a teen mom. And in the 80s, in the 70s, it's not like it is right now in 2024. You couldn't have a child when you're 16, 17 and continue to living life normally. People would judge you. You wouldn't get married to anybody. You wouldn't even go back to school. In Kenya by then, you couldn't even go back to school if you'd had a child.
Mm-hmm.
So her mother had to take me so that she goes back to school. And now she had to be lying to her friends that she doesn't have a child. You get?
Right.
So she had to be lying to her friends. She had to live this lie. And so when she got my brother, Philip, now that was her only child. And so this lie, you've gone to college with people, they know you only have one child. You start working, they know. You can't all of a sudden make an about turn and start telling people, okay, you guys, I lied. I have a kid who is this old. I had her when I was, what, 16?
Mm.
You know? So she had to sustain this lie. And the both of us, I've reached the point of empathy where I understand the both of us suffered this lie.
Yeah.
She suffered this lie, which was started by her family actually telling her, okay, go to school and don't be talking about this. This kid has gone to your grandma. And now there's no way now when you're 30, you can say, you guys, when I was 15, I did this. The society wasn't the way it is right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so every mother, I want to believe that every mother loves their child. And I want to believe somewhere in the pits of her heart, she loved me. But she had to sustain this life. So sometimes I wonder and I feel sorry for her. What it was doing to her, keeping this lie. Was she spending sleepless nights sometimes wondering, what is this child thinking? What is this child, what is she doing right now? You know,
mm-hmm.
I always give it to her sometimes. And that's why I always say that I forgave her, because I came to understand.
Yeah.
The next one was to forgive my dad for all the wrong decisions he made. My dad was a loving man, was a caring man, but of course, extremely irresponsible,
mm-hmm.
when especially it comes to money and the decisions that he made in his life. And by extension, of course, they came to affect us, you know. But life was hard. Life is still hard. I can come to a point of understanding, even with him, some of the decisions that he made. So that was the first layer of my healing journey. The first one is forgiveness. The second one is accepting. Mm-hmm. To accept that these things actually happened to me.
Yeah.
You know, to accept and say, yeah, this happened to me. Yeah, this happened to me. This happened to me. You know, and even to write a book and just bear myself to the world that.
That is a lot.
These are the things. Yeah.
Because I actually wanted to ask, did you feel like there was some kind of closure that you got when you're opening yourself out this way in the book?
A lot. I got some closure, because you wouldn't believe that some of these things that are written in this book, I thought about them for the very first time when I was writing the book. There are things that I was so far removed from. I stuck them in a pot or in a basket and put them away and moved on with my life. I had to revisit all of them and the impact and what it meant at that point for me then and for me now. You know, a lot of these scenes that I write about in the book, I had to think about them for the very first time while writing the book. So I had to accept that, wow, these things happened to me. Then the third layer was obviously seeing myself as worthy. Because when you have been rejected by a primary giver, you doubt your worth.
Right.
Yeah, and you end up either as a rebel. There are two ends of the spectrum. You can either be a rebel or you can be a people pleaser.
Mm.
And in different phases of my life, I've been both. You know, as I've told you how, you know, how I've grown up, you know, the different phases. And I know at some point I didn't even think I was lovable. I had to give people money, you know, I had to like contribute to so many things so that I can be loved, you know?
Yeah.
So I've had to look at myself and see myself for who I am, which is a very intelligent, very caring, very beautiful human being who deserves more, you know? And so I've had to accept myself as worthy. The fourth layer is obviously I create very strong boundaries around me.
Yeah.
Very strong boundaries, you know, because we give people the love. I mean, we give people we love the power to hurt us. So I have very strong boundaries with friends and people who I bring very, very close to me, because I know these are people who have the power to hurt me.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the other thing is I've just had to accept that we have no control. You and I, my dear, we have no control of what people do to us or who people are out there.
Mm.
We have no control. So we just have to create boundaries to ensure that whatever people are out there, whatever issues they have, they don't come to affect us. Yeah, so we have control of what we allow to affect us and how we react to stuff.
Mm.
Because, I mean, at the end of the day, the center is us and not them. The power is us and not them. So for me, I think those are the very many layers that I've had to go through in my healing process.
Do you have a recollection of how long it might have taken you to get to that place?
So probably from 2016 to now, that's how many, 8 years?
Yeah.
A lot of me changed. I don't think that there are two sides of me. There's me before my father died, and then there's me after my father died.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the two very different personalities. So I would say from 2016, when I went down, I hit rock bottom, is when a lot of the work started with me, even seeking professional help and all that. Yeah, that should be roughly 8 years.
Yeah, it's about eight.
And still, by the way, it's not enough, because my dear, one thing that I've realized, even when it comes to Rough Silk, when I go for live discussions, and I thank God that this is not a live discussion, because the crying that would have happened here. So when I go for live discussions with people, and people sometimes ask me questions to do with the book, when the questions have to do with my mother, or when they have to do with my brother, Philip,
mm-hmm.
I still end up crying. So I know that if to be honest, if you can tell a story without crying, I mean, in the moment I will be able to tell this story without shedding a tear or tearing or, you know, feeling a little bit overwhelmed with emotion, then I will have healed 100%. And I don't know when that is going to be. Like, mm-hmm, even mm-hmm. talking to you today, at some point, of course, I've my tears have welled. So these are deep things that take time.
Yeah.
And so we have to give time, time.
Give time, time.
Yeah.
That's very important.
Yeah.
I had to ask the question because sometimes people get to the journey of recovery and then possibly feel like, I don't see results, then just slide back.
Yeah.
That's why I had to ask you how long this has taken. And the fact that you're still doing the works.
And you know what? So after this whole, after dad died and I went through all the therapies and everything, and I actually thought that, now I'm in a good place, I've healed.
Mm.
And I always kept on saying, oh my God, I need to try this book. You know, saying that I needed to write this book took about 7 years.
Ooh.
And can you believe it? I was supposed to start writing this book in 2016, but I kept on postponing it. So now it turns out I was postponing it because there are issues that I had not dealt with. So the moment I sat down in 2022, February, to write this book, let me tell you, my dear, the moment I wrote that first sentence in the beginning, there was a tree. I cried. Oh, my God. I cried. I shed tears. I wept. And then I realized, oh, my God, I'm not even halfway, you know. And so this book became that for me. And that's why I struggled writing this book. I wrote it, I stopped, went for therapy. I started writing again, then I reached the chapter with my mother. When I reached my mother now, I stopped writing for 3 or 4 months.
Yeah.
I just couldn't. And I think I almost gave up. I just almost said, you know what, you guys, I don't think I can do this. Maybe I should change this book to be a fictional book. Like, these things happened to someone else, not me. You know?
These things happen to someone else.
Yeah. And, you know, my therapist, my husband said, no. This story will have to be told by you. It's not someone else. You can't make it a fictional book. You're going to make it, you know, and I had to come back. And I'm not saying that Rough Silk is all about the tears. And there's some very good moments. There's some very fun moments, hilarious moments, moments when we laugh. You know, there's some characters here that are very lighthearted, very nice, you know, things.
Mama, who is she?
Mama Penzi.
That was my favorite. I wanted to get to a part where she is. The moment she would say, I'm here with her, like, I want to see what she was it.
Yeah. So there's such characters, happy characters, characters of hope, characters who are lighthearted and all that. And of course, there's the heavy stuff, yeah.
The whole book is a transitional book. And look at it as that. I love transformational, actually, non-transition.
Transformational.
Yeah, I love transformational conversations. And the whole book is it. Coming from the tree to the very end of it.
Yeah.
And humanity in itself, where we hold two sides of ourselves. There's a dark and light side of every other person.
Yeah.
And we can only love ourselves wholly.
Yeah.
As we come to the end of this conversation, Deb, I notice you, I think I notice you love it when someone calls you tender. As we come to this conversation, to the end of this conversation, tender.
Yeah.
What message would you love to leave for the listener? What would you wish for them to walk away with at the end?
Wow. It's just what I told you at the end. I told you that we have no control over what people do.
Mm.
We have no control over what people do to us. First of all, we have no control over what people do. And then we have no control over what people do to us or who people are. But we have control of who we are, to people.
Yeah.
And the impact we have on them.
Mm.
Yeah, so that is it. And at the end of the day, let us not beat ourselves so much about what somebody is, what they did to us. Rather, let us just know that the power is with us and make the most of ourselves. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
And for someone that has not gotten a copy of Rough Silk, how do they get it?
There are people who still don't have a copy of Rough Silk. My goodness.
Yeah. Yeah.
Actually, especially, yeah, Rough Silk is not yet in Uganda. I'm trying to find out which is the best bookshop you guys have that has the widest reach, so that I can see whether I can negotiate something with them. This story is half Kenyan and is half Ugandan,
yeah.
And it really needs to get into Uganda.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So for somebody who does not have Rough Silk, there are three ways of getting them. In Nairobi, we have Textbook Center, which is the biggest bookshop in the country. It is all over in all malls, in all the cities. You can always get it at Textbook Center at 1,800 Kenyan shillings. You can go to Nuria. Nuria fashions itself as a bookshop for Kenyan books or African books. So it can be gotten there. Any diasporan can always get Rough Silk at Amazon.
I got my copy from Nuria.
Oh, you got your copy from Nuria?
Yeah.
Nuria's doing a good job. All the way to Uganda?
Yeah.
Wow.
How did you think I'd gotten it?
I thought a friend probably sent it to you, or a friend came to Uganda with it.
No, I handled matters myself.
Oh, thank you.
All right, Deb. Have a great evening.
Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for who you are. Thank you so much for being a person who has created a platform for people to tell their stories, my dear. It is really, really amazing. Asante sana. And I love your diction. You're very eloquent.
Thank you.
I've loved having a conversation with you. It has been very, very relaxed. Thank you so much.
I appreciate you for that. It means a whole lot coming from you. Like, we came from the beginning. I told you how I was starstruck. And I think it helped when we delayed a bit.
Yeah.
I kind of calmed down.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time you're like, I'm ready, I was like, this is a buddy. Let's go. Let's take it.
And let me ask you, why did you take a break?
When exactly?
No, from the podcast. There was a time you wrote that you've taken a little bit of a break. You're feeling a bit overwhelmed.
I started taking annual breaks because in the start, I didn't have that.
Okay.
And even the times when I felt like this is breaking my back.
Okay.
I didn't know how to move around that. And then I think it was after the 50th episode when I was like, you know what? Let me try to take a break.
Okay.
And then I did, and it felt good, and I could come back fresh. It will give me time to reflect and know how better to have these conversations.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ah, thank you so much, Asante sana. God bless you so much, right?
God bless you too. I wanted to try some Swahili. Mungu akubariki.
Asante sana. Mungu akubariki hata wewe. God bless. Bye.
Goodbye, Deb.
Okay, bye.
Thank you so much for hanging out with us to the very end. If you loved this episode, do me a favor and hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Castbox, Podbean, or any other podcast platform of your choice. It is by the power of our community that we shall make this podcast grow. Also, feel free to share your insights about what connected with you on social media, and be sure to tag us. We are at hashtag #MinabuzichwanKare on Facebook and Instagram, and on Twitter our handle is at @htnkpodcast, or you can use the hashtag #htnknation. See you next week with a brand new episode.